If you have good karma, you can do things that you want to do, and you can also trade on your good karma so long as you do not do so much horse trading that your good karma or your credit balance disappears and you get into debt, because then you've got to work hard to get out of debt. It is said that we reincarnate many times, but the time we stay in the astral plane varies according to the degree of evolution we have reached. The number of people will probably have to decline or be stabilized in the future. So what happens to all the souls who cannot come down to this material world to continue their reincarnation? Or will they have to remain in the astral for longer than their karma really permits? But there again, you see, this talk about karma. People do not have to reincarnate because of their karma, they reincarnate because they want to learn something more. You don't necessarily go to college to pay somebody else, you go to college because you want to learn something. In just the same way you come to Earth because you want to learn something. If you wanted to pay off karma, then you could pay off karma by staying in the astral. There is a lot to be done there, and in doing good for others you do pay off karma. But if you just stay in the astral, well, you remain as you were, and you are perhaps a dropout from the school of Earth. If you want to progress more, you come down to Earth and have some additional lessons in hardship, intolerance, impatience and all that sort of thing. Get this quite clear, you do not come down to Earth just because someone else says you have to, you do not come down to Earth and have some suffering just because you have misbehaved yourself. You come to learn, and if conditions are a bit hard then it's no good blaming poor old karma for it, it's what you choose yourself, it's the conditions you set up for yourself. Too many people take a rather peculiar satisfaction in saying, "Oh, I couldn't help it, my karma was against me." Of course there is karma. But then of course there are bank accounts. If you have something to sell or something which other people want, then you can get in money. If other people have something that you want, then you have to pay out for it, and that means that you lose money. In the same way with karma, if you do good to others then you are banking good karma. But if you do ill to others then you are losing your good and getting a debit of bad karma which has to be paid off sometime somewhere, not necessarily upon this earth. Remember, there are quite a lot of different worlds, and you will go to different worlds just as at school you had to go from class to class or grade to grade. Chapter 11, a man has to hold his mouth open a long time before a roasted partridge flies into it. The old man snorted in the throes of preoccupation. All these letters, all these questions, how to put within the compass of one book answers which would really help people, because that is the purpose of a book, isn't it? To help or to amuse. And this isn't an edition of comic cuts, it's meant to help, so let's get on with the first question. I'm not at all clear on this karma business. So everything we do affects someone else, does it? We must get an awful lot of karma without knowing why we've got it. No, that is not true at all. People have the weirdest ideas about karma, perhaps they haven't read my books properly. I sometimes get a letter from a person who writes so happily, "Oh, Dr. Rampa, I read Wisdom of the Ancients last night, tonight I am going to read Chapter of Life. I managed to go through you, forever in 2 hours." Well, of course that is just a waste of time. It doesn't do anyone any good, and it doesn't do an author any good to know that his books are being skinned like that. These books are meant to be studied. Karma is of vital importance to all of us, and in my books you have an opportunity of knowing what karma is all about. It means, in brief, that if you do something wrong you pay for it. If you do something good, something pays you. As I have said before, it is like a bank account. You are like a storekeeper who is good and bad on the shelves. If you sell something that is good then you get paid by good, if you sell something that is bad you get paid by having an overdraft. Now get this quite clear, whatever you do does not necessarily and automatically have an effect on any other person or creature. It depends entirely upon the circumstances. If, for example, you take a dagger and stick it into a person, then, of course, you are not doing a good deed, are you? In that case, then, you would have karma against you. But if you do something which has an effect, a bad effect upon a person you have never heard of, an effect which you certainly did not anticipate, then you do not have to come back and pay off that person. I advise you, though, to read my books more thoroughly and then you will know a lot more about karma. Question: what are we doing down here, anyhow? When we leave here, what is our objective, not just playing about in the astral, but what do we really want to do in the end? The over-self cannot of itself experience desire, suffering, pleasure, etc., as we know it on Earth, and so it is necessary for the over-self to have some other method of gaining knowledge. People upon Earth are just extensions of the over-self which can gain knowledge. For example, suppose you have a bag and you cannot get inside the bag and you cannot see inside the bag. If you can get it open enough to get your hand in, your hand, which is an extension of your other senses, can feel around inside the bag and can tell the brain what there is inside. In much the same way, the over-self gains information through the extensions called human beings. When the over-self has sufficient knowledge, when the over-self is so advanced that no more knowledge on the earth cycle is desired, then it calls home all the puppets which are humans, and they all merge again into the over-self. They become united in oneness, that is the ultimate form of existence, because although it seems to be just one entity, each part of the entity lives in rapport with the other part. You have heard of twin souls? Well, on the earth plane it is impossible for twin souls to get together, but when they return to the over-self, twin souls are reunited to form a perfect whole, and they live in a state of very great bliss until it occurs to the over-self that perhaps there is yet a higher form of knowledge which could be investigated. And then the over-self sends out puppets, not on the earth plane, but on some super plane, and the whole cycle is repeated. The puppets gather in the knowledge throughout a period which to us is eons of time. Again, when sufficient experience or knowledge has been garnered, the over-self coils in the puppets, twin souls are again united in an even greater state of bliss. Now here is a question from Miss Newman. She says, how should animals be destroyed so that death is painless and their astral body is not harmed? The best way is to inject some drug which causes the animal to lose consciousness, and then the method of disposing of the animal is not so important because there would be no pain. If an animal is made unconscious first, then it can be killed by some very rapid death-producing drug and that does not cause pain for the astral nor for the over-self. There is only distress to the astral when the physical is tormented by a slow killing. Now here is something. This is a question from a young man whom we call Agi. He will recognize himself. He is a remarkably brilliant young man who is his own worst enemy. He is a young man with truly unusual talents, and he is not using those talents to the best advantage because he wants to rebel against all authority. Agi has had a rough time, mostly of his own making. We will give two questions from Agi. The first, genius in children. How does a child become a genius? In most cases, the entity on the other side, before coming back to Earth, realizes that there is some special and specific task to do. It realizes that after a certain number of years it the entity may leave, and may perhaps leave a caretaker in its place, so the entity makes plans whereby it comes down to Earth and is born into a body with a memory and an ability to do that which has to be done. For example, an entity may decide that something has to be done about a certain form of music, so it comes down with a memory of that almost intact. Then, just about as soon as it can speak or move of its own volition, the entity finds it can compose or play, and then it is said, "We have a genius, we have an infant prodigy." Most times the poor, wretched child is stuck in front of a sign camera or something, or dumped on a stage to make money for people who do not know what it's all about, and the child is so busy making money that the inherited memory peters out. In those cases where there are no stage shows and no sign shows, the child may play divinely, and may compose exquisite music, and then when he reaches a certain age, let us say 20 years of age, the entity realizes that his task is done and he lets some other entity take over while he, the original occupant, moves on. This is called transmigration of souls, and it is far, far more common than is generally supposed. Agi has a second question, and here it is: why do Negroes rarely need tuition to play musical instruments? Negroes are a special type of people. Their basic vibrations are such that they are in tune to the music of the spheres. Often a Negro can hum music which he has never heard before. Often he can just pick up a musical instrument and play it because that is his basic makeup. You get certain classes of people such as North Europeans who are very cold and very analytical. They are very frigid in their attitude. That is their makeup. But if you get the Latin type of people, they are warm in their makeup, quick to smile, quick to pass a joke. They can see the funny side of things, particularly if the misfortune happens to someone else. That is their makeup. Negroes, for many years, have had a hard life, a life of persecution, and the only thing which has sustained them has been their musical makeup, their ability to derive consolation and solace from religious music. As such, it is part of their birthright, part of their heritage, part of their basic makeup. Negroes are usually very, very musical because their basic frequency is such that they subconsciously pick up music from other sources in much of a way similar to the poor wretched man wearing a hearing aid who sometimes picks up transmissions from the local radio taxi cab company. Well, let's get on with it. Here is a question. I am a loving mother of a 5-year-old boy, and your books, true as they are, scare me for what my son and all the other young children will have to suffer owing to events bigger than themselves. I can see him torn into pieces by atomic bombs and all grim pictures like those. His lifelines on both his hands are abruptly interrupted at an age of about 30 to 40. I can find some consolation in your books for what concerns my death, but has ever a mother of any religion rejoiced at the death of her only son? Now, you are presupposing that your son will inevitably be killed or maimed in a forthcoming war, but remember that if you give him a good education and let him specialize in something, he can be one of those protected. It is a sad thought that cannon fodder is usually the person who is easily replaceable, whereas if a man is a specialist of use to his country, he will be protected. So give your son a really good education. And in the matter of the handlines, please be assured that if these are the only indications of the termination of his life, then they mean nothing except possibly a change of career. You should never take it as definite that death will occur unless there are about 7 confirming indications. Too often palmists are guilty of criminal negligence in saying that a person is going to die, etc., etc., when it just means that they are going to change job and change location. You always state that death and after death are painless apart from the suffering at our own judgment, but in the Budo Thudol and specifically in the Chonid state the suffering seems to be atrocious. The Budo Thudol was not written in English, it was just translated into that language by some crippish Christian who altered things a bit to make it tie in with the Christian belief of hellfire and damnation. There is no hellfire and damnation. That is all a misconception fostered by priests to bolster up their own power in much the same way as some misguided parents frighten their children by threatening to call in a policeman if they don't behave. Of course, we are not happy when we are judging ourselves, it really does give us a pain when we see what stupid clods we have been. The self-contempt can be quite hellish, in fact, and well justify the description of hellfire. As one who has total recall, I tell you most emphatically that there is no torture, no atrocious pain, no ferocious suffering. Spirits who haunt old houses. Have they not been reborn yet? Spirits who haunt old houses have nothing to do with current entities. For example, a person dies in tragic circumstances, and much energy is generated, but the person can go to a completely different plane and even be reborn while the energy which was generated will be dissipated in the form of hauntings. It's much the same as heating a piece of metal. The heat remains in the metal, although gradually fading, for quite a time after the source of heating has been removed. Here is a thought for you. It is quite possible for a person who dies in extremely difficult circumstances to have his energy as a thought form which haunts a place, and even to haunt the newborn incarnation who caused all the trouble in the first case. Are humans ever reborn as animals? The Budo seems to be pretty incoherent in the matter, or maybe I don't understand. No, humans are never reborn as animals, and animals are never reborn as humans. Nothing that you can do can turn a cabbage into a cow, nor can you change a rhinoceros into a rose, but I have dealt with this enough on preceding pages. What is nervous force, anyway? What's the good of telling us about nervous force if we have no idea what it is? Nervous force is the power which generates the etheric, and nervous force properly directed can rotate a paper cylinder, as I say in one of my books. Everybody, whether animal or human, is a generator of electricity. Even the earth has its magnetic force, its magnetic field if you prefer to call it that. And just as a radio program has to have a carrier wave to support it, so does a human have to have an etheric consisting of nervous force or energy which propagates the aura. This in its turn originates from certain cells in the brain. The food we eat goes into the blood, and some of that food well mixed with oxygen goes to highly specialized brain cells, and provides the food for the generation of an electric current which powers the thought impulses. This is nervous force. If you find it difficult to believe, remember that you can get a device consisting of a zinc case with a few chemicals and a carbon rod inside it. If you connect that to a piece of wire inside a glass bulb from which air has been withdrawn, you get a light, don't you? An electric light. So you get electricity from chemical reaction, and in the human you get electricity from chemical reaction provided by the food we eat. I have a letter here from Mr. H. Mr. H. writes, I have enclosed two questions which you may care to answer. I would be very interested in the answer to question one, and would like to expand it a little. In addition to the matter of personal responsibility, which I think very important, I am confused on the matter of personal identity. This really boils down to the definition of the word I. While I can see that in many ways I am not the same I that I was 20 years ago and presumably will not be the same as 20 years hence, yet I retain a sense of identity between these various I's. However, if an over-self can operate 10 puppets, what happens to the sense of I? And when all puppets are dead, does the over-self then continue to operate 10 astral puppets, and continuing the thought into the future? What happens if the 10 puppets half succeed in liberating themselves? On a more particular note, I have often wondered why it was necessary for you to pick such an arduous route for your journey to the West. Would it not have been possible for you to go to a university in India or Europe, and could not funds have been deposited in the West for your use? Many of your troubles seem to have stemmed from a lack of money. Well, Mr. H., let's see what we can do to answer your queries. Actually, I think most of them have already been answered in this book or in previous books, but let us write you an imaginary letter. Dear Mr. H., you really are in a state of confusion, aren't you? Much of your confusion arises from the fact that one has to write in three-dimensional terms and attempt to describe the operation of an over-self working, say, in a nine-dimensional plane of existence. You say that you think a puppet loses personal identity. But of course, if you think about it, that is not the case. Look at that matter like this: forget all about anything outside the body, and assume for the purpose of this explanation that the body is compartmental. The brain, then, represents the over-self, and everyone knows that the brain directs the hands, the fingers, etc. The fingers represent puppets, and the brain can suggest that the fingers do something, but the fingers are still separate entities or separate individuals. They can feel and they can become highly skilled. In fact, at times they seem to work of their own volition. The heart is another mechanism which cannot be controlled, except in abnormal cases, by the brain, over-self, because if the brain, representing our over-self, got in a bad temper, then conceivably it could stop the heart from beating, and that would destroy the entire mechanism of brain over-self and the organ's puppets. So, you see, the actual over-self provides the substance from which the human astrals are made, and each entity or human body has full control and full choice of action, always provided that such action will not jeopardize the over-self human organism. Take a big firm with many branches. There you have a chairman of the board of directors or a president. You have many departmental heads, and many general managers to staff all the district branches, and all these people work with their own responsibility while working within the framework of company policy. They do not have to tell the chairman of the board of directors every little thing, Nor do they have to telephone him every moment about decisions which they are qualified to make. The chairman of the board of directors or the president, call him what you wish, represents the overself, and all the departmental heads and managers are the puppets. You ask what happens when the puppets die, as the overself, derived of its 10 or so puppets, immobilized, you say. Let me ask you a question. What happens if one of the branch managers retires or is removed for some particular reason? The firm or branch does not close down. Instead, a fresh manager, or puppet, is appointed. And anyhow, in this chapter and possibly the chapter before, I have already discussed how puppets return to the overself. Yes, I could have taken an easy way. I could have gone to a university, I could have had sacks of gold all around me, but tell me, Mr. H., what sort of knowledge would I have gained then? I would be the reflection of other people's knowledge, some of it which is, admittedly, faulty. I would not have gained the knowledge of life which I have at present and which is very painfully first-hand, believe me. People who go to a university and learn everything the soft way merely learn the opinion of others from printed pages which may be years out of date. In a university, a student may not dare to question the precepts of another. One is taught that it is impossible to do a thing except in the way specified in the textbook, but the people who have not been to a university just go ahead and do the impossible thing anyway. Royce of Rolls-Royce, Edison, Ford, and thousands of other very intelligent men did not go to a university, so they did not know that the thing which they wanted to do was impossible. They did not know that such a thing was impossible because they lacked the education to read the textbooks which really are the opinions of other people. And so Royce, Edison, Ford and others just went ahead and invented the things which textbooks would say were impossible. So attendance at a university can be a drawback. That should straighten out a few questions for you, Mr. H., and I hope that you now find your thoughts are more settled. Another question asks why we have illness and how would it be possible to detect illness through the aura. Well, illness and disease come either from within or without. When it comes from without, a germ or virus can be caught from another person and it is not the fault of a body that catches it. When we have a case of illness from within, that is, when the disease comes from within, the body chemicals are affected because everything comes from thought. What the electricians call electromotive force comes into play. Thought is electric impulses. When we think, we generate electricity. The electricity is thus the electromotive force which causes our muscles to work, or even upsets our body chemistry. If a person is frustrated, worried, sad, bad-tempered, etc., or has an abnormal emotion, their thoughts generate an electric current which is defective. It may not have the necessary correct waveform, and because the electric current is defective, it causes wrong messages to go to the glands and the glands' secretion change to cope with the wrong thoughts and the wrong messages caused by those wrong thoughts. After a time, the most susceptible part is affected by the changed secretions, or changed chemical balance of the body. It may be the muscles that are affected, and so one gets, perhaps, muscular dystrophy. Or it might be something to do with the bones, it might be arthritis, or, if some wrong message causes a disturbance in the stomach, the gastric juices may become too acid, too strong, and then we might have an ulcer. Closer to home, if the messages are too localized and affect the brain, then there might be a brain tumor. If the chemistry can be studied, then it can be corrected by hormone treatment or some other appropriate treatment, and the disease can be cured if it is caught in time. If too much damage has been done, then it can't be cured but can be alleviated. The person should remedy the thing or emotion that caused the damage in the first place by getting a more balanced outlook, by controlling the emotions, or by a changed set of circumstances such as fresh job, fresh partner, etc. All these things can be seen in the aura. Whatever happens to a body can be seen in the aura. Looking at the aura is like looking at radar pictures. You can see land or a storm disturbance which is quite beyond ordinary sight. Whether an illness starts from within or without, it can be detected from the aura. If one catches an infection from some other person, then it takes a certain time for that illness to manifest substantially in the physical, Yet in the aura at the exact instant when the infection took place, it shows quite clearly. It shows like lines of stress. If the illness is caused from within, then a periodical examination of the aura will show the danger of an illness quite a long time before the body is seriously affected, and so the illness can be cured almost before it has become apparent. In connection with this, I have been working on such a matter for a whole lifetime, and the biggest difficulty has been getting people to part with their clothes. There was a certain noble lady in England with whom I was discussing the matter. We were only talking about it, and this very noble lady, who had been married and has a family of her own, said, "Oh, you want nude bodies? Most definitely I should do everything to oppose anything which required a woman to remove her clothing or to expose certain portions of her body." I, with great restraint, refrained from reminding the noble lady that even she had to expose a certain portion of her body so that her babies could be born. Chapter 12. If you don't believe in others, how can you expect others to believe in you? The old man lay back on his bed. The evening sun was just setting behind the low hills, sending its last rays gleaming on the placid water of the St. John River. Off to the left, the paper factory was still belching out furious clouds of smoke and steam as it did 24s a day, obscuring the sky and polluting the atmosphere. Into the river poured all the waste products, making an incredible stench in the air of St. John, a stench about which everyone complained, and about which no one did anything. The snows were melting fast. This was spring, the start of spring, but now with the fast setting sun dipping behind the hills, birds were scurrying along in droves, hurrying to get home to their perches, while the light yet held. Directly below the window, St. John, a telepathic cat, was singing a lonely song, inviting all the cat ladies of the neighborhood to come and be welcomed by him. His voice rose and fell, quavering with the intensity of his emotion. From time to time he stopped, raised his head high, and even sat upright on his back legs like a rabbit while he listened intently for any calls that his invitation was being accepted. Disappointed that he had no such intimation, he dropped to all fours again, and with his tail twitching with emotion he started all over again like an old-time London costermonger, crying his wares, but nothing of any old iron, any old rags. This was a different cry, love for free, come quick, I'm waiting. Cars drove up with a roar and a clatter, and storekeepers and their assistants drove into the parking lot with much elan and got out of their cars with great slamming of doors and calling of good night, before hurrying up the steps in the constant fight to get room in the elevator. The old man lay back and thought of the past, thought of the difficulties of this life, thought of the few, few pleasures and the many, many hardships. A hard life, yes, he thought. But, praise be, the last time on this round, the last time on this earth. And now, he thought, I have just about cleared up all that has to be done, cleared up all those empty corners, turned out the attics, even tossed out the garbage. Not so, not so, said a most familiar and well-loved voice. The task is not yet ended, you have done more than you came to do. But, the task is not yet ended. The old man turned on his side, and there right close to him was the superastral figure of the Lama Minya donned up, smiling and with a brilliant gold radiance. You quite startled me, said the old man. And I wish you'd turn your light slow, it reminds me of when I was in England, in London. Oh, what was that? Asked the Lama Minya donned up. Is it something which I do not know? I think it must be, said the old man, let me tell you about it. I was in a building in South Kensington late at night, and I was sitting in the dark thinking, just thinking over things, just meditating, and for some reason I had not pulled the blinds. Suddenly there came a tremendous knocking at the door down below. I started back to awareness and went down to see what was the cause of the commotion. Two big beefy London bobbies were there. Sir, said one, a sergeant I saw by his stripes, what are you doing in this building? Doing? I replied. I don't think I was doing anything. I was just sitting thinking as a matter of fact. Well, replied the sergeant, we were called here in a great hurry, because you were shining very bright lights out of the window. Oh, I replied, I most certainly was not, but if I had been, is that a crime? The sergeant looked at his subordinate, and shrugging his shoulders said, "Well, it might be, you know. You might be signaling to a crime gang to show that the road is clear or something." Then he came to a decision. "I want to search the place," I said. "Have you a search warrant?"